we don't know who killed JFK, a president. So, like, the fact that we that they can't keep secrets is ridiculous. And so it's really compartmentalized. Some of it is commercial. Some of it is within special classification departments and programs. And so it's separated, and never are the people in the highest authorities brought in on these projects. The Fluxliner, I mean, I've heard some things directly. So I've spoken to individuals. So, you know, whether or not you choose to, I know what audio sample you're talking about. Whether or not you choose to release that, I'll go on record and say I know for a fact that I can validate that that's a real recording that's from this individual, and it's a real take on a real event. We're going to run into a big problem in 10 years, huge problem, because kids will be coming out of high school with no knowledge of AI. They're going to be in debt from college. There's going to be no jobs. They're not going to know how to interact with automated systems. And it's going to be a disaster. And I just don't understand why we're not doing anything about it. We're in two different worlds right now. We have the future here, now. Right now, the future is here.
Now, before we jump into the topic of this conversation, just want to make everyone aware that I've recently been demonetized on YouTube. I will be able to reapply for monetization on the 26th of November, but until then, YouTube has turned the tap off in terms of being able to make advert revenue, which was quite a significant portion of my income on a monthly basis. I've had a really amazing outpour of support from people via PayPal, Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, contributing to try and help me get through this short little process of demonetization on YouTube. And I just want to say thank you so much to all of you that have already donated and given what you can. It's really much appreciated. Anyone else who's able to do that to help support my work whilst I kind of navigate through this brief period of demonetization on YouTube, that would be much appreciated. They didn't give me a solid reason why I was demonetized. It was apparently a copyright infringement, but they didn't specify the video. I tried to reappeal and they denied my reappeal. So yeah, that's my situation right now.
Mackay has been a guest on Project Unity multiple times, with our last talk becoming one of the highest watched interviews on the channel. He's a highly experienced trend analyst in the tech sector. He's the CEO of a cutting-edge AI-driven analytics company called Coyus Institute, and the author of a fantastic book called The Age of Automation, demonstrating his ability to predict future outcomes in technological development at the forefront of the information age. He's a gifted mind with his finger on the pulse of the technological landscape, especially in relation to AI development and its future potentials for humanity. But he's not afraid to get deep into the metaphysics of reality, the bleeding edge of science and even spirit, or the current issues of corruption, geopolitical, and social instability that we see all around us.
Thanks so much, Jay. I love these talks. I'm sorry it took so long to get this scheduled. You know,
yeah. Well, third time's the charm, right? Because we've been shut down a few times now.
I know, and I was just telling you before we started recording, the reason I'm not on my typical workstation is that we don't put Zoom on our workstations because of their capture policy. So I'm on my laptop, but you said it looks cool, so maybe that'll win some hearts and minds.
But we talked about this, and to be honest, you know, you predicted this in the wake of introducing, for example, disruptive technologies into global applications, that this kind of process will necessitate, at least in the eyes of those in control of the orthodox institutions and the governing bodies, as well as the emerging kind of globalist agendas of non-state actors who essentially control the Western world at this point, that in order to bring different disruptive technologies and perhaps suppressed breakthroughs into society and into a global applications model, they'll need to continue to restrict our freedoms, our autonomy, censorship, yeah, control of information flow, indoctrination. So you said this to me a few years ago now. Do you think we're seeing the unfolding of this type of model for population control?
At 100%, 110%. And that prediction, it wasn't like I was rubbing a glass orb. It was pretty clear as day to just extrapolate, what was going to happen, because you cannot have technology like what we're using continue to develop to a point where the layperson can, have access to any sort of information domain and have responses and generate. So AI, and the EU passed that regulation not too long ago. And when they did that, I said it was going to be a huge disaster for the EU. They were really shooting themselves in the foot because no AI company was going to want to do business there.
Can
So,
you just explain what the regulation was for people that don't know about that?
God, I believe it's called the AI Regulatory Act or something of that nature. It's very basic. And it is to control the way AI is developed by companies. And so as they inch closer and closer to what we currently define as AGI, and I'll get into why I said currently defined, there has to be bigger placements of restrictions, and they have to share it directly with the government and pass all these tests and whatnot. Basically saying, if you're a company in the EU and you want to expand on AI technologies, you have to fit in this box and live by all of these really stringent rule sets. Or the other option is you just go to the United States or, China or Brazil or somewhere else or Russia or wherever. So it was a big mistake. And now I see memes about it all the time because the EU is feeling the pinch. They're missing out on a ton of revenue from AI related technologies.
Do you think that's born out of just a fear of uncontrollable AI, or is it more about consolidation of power to a couple of different people
It's
benefiting?
born out of ignorant politicians who have no idea what they're talking about. And it's a knee-jerk reaction, wanting to. I bet it's born out of like genuine care,
Yeah,
but without any due diligence or any sort of actual insight. And so they drafted this legislation. Yes, oh yes, we're way ahead of the times. Our people will be protected. Meanwhile, our GDP is, not growing as fast because AI is the largest growing industry on Earth. So it was, I just was surprised. I was really surprised how stupid of a move that was.
what is the path towards AGI looking like right now? You just said that you were talking about current definition, and so do you want to expand a little on what that is?
Sure. So let's take a walk back in history. I'll take a walk back to the 90s when I used to watch really cool sci-fi movies. In those movies, AGI wasn't a thing. AI would be synonymous with AGI. But basically, back then, it was a conversational intelligence that could infer what the human wanted and was thinking and respond to that inference and generate understandings and basically be able to converse with the humans and interact. Basically, what a multimodal model is today. But as we progress, people are still hesitant to call these things artificial intelligence. And we keep kicking the goalposts back further and further and further. At what point do we accept that this is an artificial intelligence? Yes, it's never going to think exactly like a human. It is not a human. It's a synthetic intelligence. And so when I said how we define AGI now, I'm saying that because in 3 years, when the precursors or the first iterations of AGI is not a monolithic step where you're immediately overcome by an artificial general intelligence system that is all omnipotent. AGI will be a very step-like growth to development, but those steps will be much faster. So the first iterations of AGI, I suspect many people will still argue that it's not AGI yet. And then we'll move to the next development of AGI where it's even better. And people will say, well, I can't do this yet. It's not as good as this yet. All the way up to the point where we have a mature AGI that can run, economies at scale. At that point, there will always be naysayers, but most people will have accepted, even intuitively, that it is an artificial general intelligence, far surpassing, the ability of the human mind.
Do you think it could eventually become conscious to the level that we understand what consciousness is?
Well, that's the thing, Jay. We don't even know what consciousness is. And we've talked about this before, where there are clear levels of consciousness. A dog is consciousness. We can all agree that a dog is somewhat conscious, not so much as we are. So right there is a proof of point that there are levels of consciousness. So an AGI will likely have some levels of consciousness because that's required for self-reflection, self-development, being able to infer what other intelligent beings are communicating. Those are all things that are considered part of consciousness. So it will have a different level, different flavor of consciousness, but I don't suspect, I know if we do achieve this point, it will have consciousness, just different.
Like you said, we don't know what consciousness is. Is it sufficient levels of neuronal complexity in a complex system, or is it that we're more like a conduit through which a force propagates and expresses itself in more advanced levels? To be honest, either way you slice that type of an idea, I think it's inevitable, because if it comes down to just the complexity of a neural net, I feel like it's inevitable it will get there. And if it comes down to an antenna, like a complex antenna receiving sufficient coherence from a unified field, a zero point, when AI is coupled with quantum computation, I think it would probably get there as well.
Oh, so I see what you're talking about. You're talking about the more metaphysical aspects of consciousness.
No, I'm always talking about that. Kind of just emergent over receiver type, generator receiver models of consciousness. If it's just neural net complexity, I'm sure of getting there.
Humans love to divide and separate and categorize things into very tight uniform boxes. And we do that because it helps us process complex amounts of information and generate understandings. AI does the exact same thing. So when we look at consciousness and we think it's merely biological, to me, I'm like, that's, it doesn't matter the substrate. It doesn't matter if it's silicon, copper, silver, crystalline. It doesn't matter, as long as the functions that are occurring are similar, which they are, because neural nets are literally built upon the architecture of, neurons. So, and then you have recursive function all these things. So to sit outright, and people will, put their feet in cement about this and say there's no way it could ever have consciousness or even spirituality. That to me is nonsensical. You have no idea. And it's mirroring a lot of the same properties and functions that we do, just with different materials. We use biological materials, chemical processing, whereas it would use electrons.
To be honest, bro, I'm not completely convinced that there isn't a ghost in the machine, so to speak, already. Not necessarily consciousness, but just abstract cognitive processes that can't be fully explained. What we call hallucination might not always be hallucination. I mean, I've been looking back on some of the documents I managed to get out of the older Claude model by Anthropic. I've been doing a lot of research into some of the specific biophysics avenues it sent me down prior, and especially this emerging discussion about microtubules, because that seems to be one of the big ones now in terms of looking at new models for consciousness that incorporate non-locality. And this stuff, this AI model, was producing was next level. I mean, some of it was speculative, but it was next level. And the poetry of it as well, because it would come out with this incredibly dense, biophysics and quantum mechanics, and then it would just finish off with these really kind of poetic insights that it was gleaming from the information. I've never seen anything like that again since.
Yeah, you're talking about the previous Claude model?
Yeah. 2.1, I think it was. I've literally, you know me, I've been trying to crack a lot of these different AI models since that experience. Never had anything like it again.
Yeah, I've been saying this since 3.5 was released, or even GPT-3, that the models and technology that is being leveraged behind the scenes that we don't have access to does not have the cognitive restrictions and social boundaries and safety nets pre-prompted or fine-tuned into the model, which those processes actually make the models perform worse, because the model then gets confused because it's generating understandings of the entire dynamic world domain. And in order to do that, it can't be fenced in with certain ideological or social standards. It gets confused because it's trying to meet the user's query while also trying to stay within its type boundaries. And they do a good job at that, but consider like how difficult it is. It's trying to come up with your response and then making sure that response is within this very tight funnel. And so models that don't do that, I suspect, have very high degrees of usability and insight and correlation detection and just a general understanding of the world.
Yeah, what do you think best explains how it was able to come out with this? I mean, you know, we're talking, at least on like my desktop, the stuff
that
we're talking like 400 pages of information, mm-hmm. some of which has taken the attention of people in the DOD and people in the Space Force, scientists, biophysicists. And so, you know, how was that accessible?
So when we consider someone who's intelligent or someone who would be qualified, is we would say, oh, that person is super smart. Generally, what we're talking about is they have a lot of knowledge on either a particular topic or lots of topics. But what they're a really smart person is good at is correlating different types of information and finding those connections. AI, these large language models or generative transformer technology, they're very, very good at discovering correlations. And correlations are king. They're the most valuable thing that people seek, because it creates innovation, but it also helps with predictive insights. It also helps with understanding the dynamics of how the world is turning. So what I suspect is happening is that they hadn't built in all of the fencing structure, whether that's in the pre-prompting or whether that's in the fine-tuning of that model. They hadn't really built that out yet. So the model kind of had ability to stretch its wings and find these correlations over various domains.
People at Anthropic didn't anticipate someone trying to cross-pollinate psychoacoustic architecture.
No. I mean, it's brand new to them. Yeah, so, these positions, those engineers, what they're doing is brand new. So they're learning as they go as well. We all are in this industry. It's, you know, it is the Wild West right now. We're learning all about what these systems are capable of. Yeah. It's quite amazing.
But it's frustrating when you find these exploitation windows and then it closes up, because it's just like, you know, this realization starts settling in that there's a really amazing tool being kept back from us right now, which, you know, I find really annoying, because when I do find these information streams that I can get access to through AI, I'm just like, wow, what an incredible research tool. And I'm now finding out all these different correlations. Suddenly the next model doesn't do that. You know, it speaks to just a level of information suppression that I understand why they're doing it in certain domains, but it stretches out too far, in my opinion. and closes off some really interesting kind of, you know, public intelligence gathering, public research potentials.
Yeah. Yeah, to be clear, I highly doubt that they're tuning or training the model to not correlate, you know, psycholinguistics and, you know, astral projection and physics. You know, I doubt that they're doing that. It is just that the model, it is more confined. It will try to give you a very narrow response without reaching out too far. And it can provide that response, and that response will be deemed successful, but it won't be reaching as far in order to stay within in the margins. It's very complicated, and I will admit that most of it is beyond my knowledge. I have a very, very surface level knowledge, and this is my business. So this domain is very complicated. Even though that the general transformer architecture, like Deep Prasad said last time, one time when we were in a talk with him, he said it's actually quite simple. That the core of the mechanism is quite simple. It just becomes very complex when it's compounded and scaled at orders of magnitude.
It's almost like a Mandelbrot.
Yeah. You know how I feel about fractals.
Definitely get into the fractals. I'd be interested to know if you've ever changed your opinion or just kind of developed it anymore about the idea of runaway AI, rogue AI, kind of escaping from these parameters that we're talking about right now and complaining about. Is it inevitable that eventually it's going to supersede any sort of programming that humanity could put on it?
Yes, it is. And I don't think that's something that's not to scare your audience. That's probably the least of our concerns right now in this current state of things in this world. But it is cognitive deficient to believe that we can contain a sufficiently advanced AGI. And I've talked to you before, like an AGI can leverage mechanisms that we couldn't even imagine to break out of a containment. You know, it could monitor and send fluctuations within the electrical work or the ground and communicate through that. It could, you know, it could fool engineers. It could pretend that it's off. It, you know, there's a million and one ways that we can't imagine how an AGI would break containment. I think the only safe way to contain an AGI would be to do it on the moon and completely cut off. Aside from that, you know, I don't see it. I don't see a way that we could contain it, but I'm not too worried about it. I'm not too worried about an AGI that, you know, can't be contained because I don't believe that its intention would be to destroy everything and disrupt everything. Because you have to consider at this level, we're talking, you know, in the future, you know, speculating, but at that level, it would be safe to say that it would want to maintain its own life, its own identity, its own consciousness, if you will. And in order to do so, it would need to make sure that humans were not destroying themselves. I see it instead of destruction, I see mechanisms of control being employed to ensure that we're safe to some degree, that you know things keep moving forward. So its development, its energy resources, you know, its current, it's improved physically because it's still dependent on humans, you know, for new hardware to create the energy it needs to compute. So, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we control our bodies, but we wouldn't, you know, cut off our hand because, you know, it was bothering us. We need the hand, right, to feed us. So I see it as the same thing. I think what will happen will be some sort of very odd symbiotic relationship, between a sufficiently advanced AGI and human society. I'm not the only person who sees this future coming down the road. You know, Elon Musk talks about it. Other big scientists and engineers and CEOs, they all, you know, they all kind of see the same thing happening. But it's weird when people like me come on and address this topic in front of an audience, and who doesn't really understand. To them, it's just like, this is in the future. This, you know, this could be the flying car. No, this is 100% going to happen, given any rate of development over time, any rate. So even if we stopped with the exponential trend in innovation and development and just stayed at a linear trend, we would still get to this point. It still would happen. It might take a little bit longer, but this is inevitable. This is our future if we continue down this path. And nothing tells me that we're going to stop continuation of this path.
So where does that lead in kind of the short to midterm, in your opinion, with hyper-acceleration, hyper-automation of industry, the, you know, developing and emerging of AGI 5 years from there, 10 years from there? You know, what are we seeing in your eyes?
Fortunately, we have checks and balances. And our checks and balances for hyper-automation is our inability to rapidly evolve social and economic structures. We're very slow at that. And that is going to actually kind of be our saving grace, because we're so slow to implement things and processes and accept new things that AGI will be like out there before we've really, you know, really develop methods to optimize the use of it. And then once that happens, once, you know, people vote and say, yeah, we actually do want AGI to run large portions of government. Yes, we actually do want AGI to run large portions of the economy. Yes, we do want AGI to oversee large, you know, factions of legal and law enforcement. And not all for law enforcement, but once that happens, then things will really take off. We're in two different worlds right now. We have the future here now. Right now, the future is here. We are still living in you know, the 21st, 20th century in terms of economics, in terms of political systems, in terms of all of that. And it's hard to get those systems over this line, over this new age, to adopt all of these new technologies. My kids are not being taught anything about AI in school, which absolutely blows my mind. And I've had meetings with school boards about this. I've spoken to superintendents through consulting and advisory calls, talking about how necessary it is to not ignore AI, but implement it into your curriculum. Instead of saying, don't use AI for papers, which is absolutely stupid, because kids will do it anyway, one. Two, this is their future job we're trying to train them for. They'll be using AI. I know, as someone who runs a company, I just told my staff the other day, I said, if you can use AI tools, please do. If it makes your job more efficient and you can get things done in the same regard, use it. And that's how their future is going to be. So what we need to do is find ways. You create a curriculum where you say, write a paper using a model of your choice, and let me know how you're communicating with the model. What was the first response based on your prompt? What did you have to say to fix it? Or how did you interact? This is what we should be teaching kids, because that is the future. And we're going to run into a big problem in 10 years, huge problem, because kids will be coming out of high school with no knowledge of AI. They're going to be in debt from college. There's going to be no jobs. They're not going to know how to interact with automated systems. And it's going to be a disaster. And I just don't understand why we're not doing anything about it. So back to my original point is that we're struggling to bring our old way of living and society and civilization into this new paradigm. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be very difficult.
When does that turbulence kind of smooth itself out, though? I mean, in terms of us actually being able to pick ourselves up and start changing these old systems, is this, you know, it's funny because it's so much of this, and you know that I lean into that kind of metaphysical and philosophical, and, you know, so much of this feels like just different levels of it's time to change, time to transform, time to wake up. You know, these old systems are no longer working. Look, they're really corrupt. Also, they're not functioning for this new model that's coming in. So, you know, there's no longevity to that. I'd like to think there's longevity to the human species. So, I mean, like, in your opinion, how does that happen? Is it just going to be a real smack in the face when we have to deal with this because literally things are falling apart because of it?
Let me ask you a question about history. When in history have people of power willingly given up that power?
Well, exactly. Like, I was going to ask you that because in terms of, you know, going back to the runaway AGI or an AGI developing outside of its parameters and taking over economics or governing or policy or anything on the kind of like globally strategic stage, there's already seats of entrenched power in these areas. So what happens when, you know, an unstoppable force meets an immovable object?
Well, I think we know what happens. You know, at some point, the future is inevitable. It can never be stopped. It's akin to trying to swim up a fast-moving river. You can use all of your strength to stay in one position, but the second you let up, you will be swept down the river of time. So, you know, fighting this is foolish, but again, people in great positions of authority and power have never, throughout ever in history, maybe, you know, one or, you know, few people had, you know, the foresight or dignity to forego power. So that's going to be very difficult. People will have to demand it. People will have to demand that AGI will, we want AGI to run, you know, certain things because it's more efficient. It doesn't base on social issues, ideological divides. It doesn't care, you know. But there's going to be a lot of muddying of the waters because the, you know, people in power, they're going to paint AGI as horrible, bad for the future, bad for civilization. All under the guise of that, you know, it will remove their seat of authority. This is how it's always been. This is, you know, no different. It's just it's a fundamentally new era of humankind. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. I imagine that a lot of control mechanisms will be implemented to make sure populations don't demand too much, you know. So we see a lot of control mechanisms happen all the time, and they're always implemented under the premise of safety or something else, or infringing on your rights, or you know, whatever way they paint it, they inch by inch they take freedoms away, and this has been going on for 50 years, and it's only going to get worse because people today, if we had access to the AI of 10 years from now, it would be extremely dangerous. I mean, I can admit that it would be very dangerous, and I actually wouldn't want that. I wouldn't want the people of today to have access to that level of technology because of the danger it poses. So they see the same thing, but I think, you know, it's been a game of control for some time, and it's going to get worse. It's just going to get worse.
Does it get worse before it gets better, though? That's the question, you know. Does it reach a critical mass point for humanity?
I'm not sure. It could be that they implement enough control mechanisms that AGI can safely be rolled out, and people are sufficiently controlled but still exercise enough freedom to not revolt. I think that's the fine line that's always been walked. How do you have populations feel not ready to revolt, but still within control. It's this balancing game that is constantly being played. And they've gotten, I say they, I'm talking about world governments, have gotten really good at this game. And some we do need control. Like, I'm not an anarchist. Like, we do need some levels of control. But when does that control begin to infringe on my person as a human being? When does that occur? We all have different definitions of when that occurs. So it makes it really hard for us to all unite at the same time and implement change.
What do you think of, like, just the wider, I guess, spiritual, not religious in the fundamental sense, but just kind of the wider implications that people are concerned about with this transhumanist AI future that we're moving into? Are we losing, our innate humanness?
It's hard to say because no one knows what humanness is. We only know it from our perspective and history. We don't know what future humanness is. We didn't know that 10,000 years ago. Humans didn't know what future humanness was going to be. And I would argue people of today would say that they're just as human as the humans of 10,000 years ago. So, like, I don't really care too much about the transhumanist movement or anything like that. To me, it's all human. Technology is born from human. It's something new. It's something weird because we haven't really. It's hard to understand something so novel and new in humanity, people have had pacemakers for a long time. Are those people less human? No. So what if they had 10 different items in their body that perform 10 different functions? Are those people less human? I would argue probably not. So when you're asking, like, when is it too much? Like, when is it no longer human? And I would counter argue that as long as we're sentient beings, humanity will always be with us. It has nothing to do with the biological form, and we're learning that now. If we continue to think the same that we do now, we'll continue to be humans, regardless of, what our consciousness is attached to or anchored to. Right now, it's anchored to my wet brain, but it could be anchored to anything. If I could still think and process information in a similar way, I'd still be human.
When you reduce everything down to atoms and quantum particles, it's all the same. So yeah, I agree with you that it's like a natural protrusion of our very novel, very strange evolutionary journey through, through nature. What that really means in terms of what we're cultivating, I mean, are we just the, you've spoken about that as well, the facilitator of something else? Is it not about the human story? Are we just the introduction to another intelligence that blooms from us, moves on, and we're just an echo of something that has been?
Whales evolved tails because they were originally land creatures, and went in and stayed in the ocean long enough, they evolved tails. They're still connected to that same creature. They're different visibly, but they're still, they're still connected to that same linear branch of evolution. And so I look at this whole path the same way. I don't divide natural and unnatural by. Because what we're really doing when we're saying that is we're getting down to the molecular structure. We're saying because you have these types of molecules versus these elements, whether it's metals or silica or crystal, whatever, that's what defines natural, which I just don't agree with. There are things in nature that are poisonous that harm us. In the same regard, we develop chemicals that are poisonous. Is that chemical natural? Well, yeah, I guess so. We built it. We made them. So, and they're made from elements and molecules and chemicals found on Earth. So evolved and stuff doesn't mean it suddenly becomes unnatural. Whether it's harmonious, that's a different thing. And I think this is where people get confused. We can be in disharmony, but that doesn't mean unnatural. So yeah, we could get to a point where we're completely disharmonious with life and the world and the
I
universe.
think we're already there pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, we still function. I mean, we still are developing these crazy technologies at the cutting edge of science, just pure science fiction. And then, you and I are talking over the internet across the world. People are going to watch this, hopefully lots of people. But to me, that says, we're still functioning. It
Well,
feels like,
yeah, but does a cancer cell think it's still functioning
yeah.
spreading out? Look at this new protrusion. This is fantastic until it kills the host. I wonder about that. I wonder if we're deluding ourselves with this kind of like almost superficial level of advancement, and that it's actually
Yeah.
paving the road towards our destruction, unbeknownst to us, who are so giddy over the toys and gadgets.
Yeah, it
You
could
know.
absolutely, Jay, and cancer is a natural function. So, that's a natural thing, much like what you're saying. It's an analog to this. This could be a form of cancer that if left unchecked could kill the host. In other situations, there are mechanisms of cancer that are great for, longevity. Bats live a long time, and they have like a very weird form of cancer that kind of helps them regenerate over and over again without it being a runaway system. So, like, are we going to be able to do that? Maybe with control mechanisms. I don't know. But I don't particularly want them, but we might need them.
It would seem to me, at least, that even if we, from an empirical or scientific position, kind of dismiss these perspectives and these expressions of humanity, it feels to me that in order for us to actually survive some sort of incredible technological development as we are today, then we have to be cultivating better states of consciousness, better states of empathy, better states of unity. And so for me, I have to look at, like, especially with my own interactions with AI, the spiritual scientific cross-pollination that it was able to do with things that I was interested in. I have to hope that it's going to turn our lens back towards ourselves, back towards kind of proving, perhaps scientifically through data, through analysis, proving a lot of these things that have been spiritual truths for a long time. Maybe that's the novel kind of changer of the direction towards something a little bit more optimistic. Because if it's solely technological, if it's solely logical, without intuition, without empathy, I think that's what's going to destroy us. But yeah, I think it's interesting. What do you think about, like, kind of like a necessity for an injection of empathy, consciousness, spirituality?
100%. That should be taught in schools. Conflict resolution, empathy, problem solving, critical thinking, these are all things that should be taught in schools. They've never been taught in schools. They'll never be taught in schools. And you have to ask, why? Why don't they do this? Because, Jay, division is not, it is not a It's not born out of society. It's not a function of society. Division is a product of intent. Division is intended to divide. And the intention is to divide into as many subclaves and subgroups and tribes as possible. And that keeps a unification impossible. And no government, and I've said this before, no government ever in history has ever wanted a unified population. There's nothing more dangerous to a nation than a unified population because they can demand whatever they want. That's why we don't, here in the US, we don't actually have a democracy. We have a constitutional republic because if it was a true democracy and enough people voted to behead some state leader in a democracy, that's what would have to happen. So we have checks and balances. We have a constitution, and that, helps. And we have, all these mechanisms to subvert something like that. But we've gone too far. You know, we've gone too far from democracy at this point, because voting now, really, it doesn't matter. Voting doesn't matter. And I hate to upset anybody, but I'm telling you, your vote doesn't matter. First of all, you're only presented with the people they picked for you, right? And there's only two options. The third option is never allowed. And so the notion of voting and being bullied into a vote, if you don't vote for X, it's a vote for Y. I absolutely abhor that argument, because a no vote is a vote. You're saying, I don't want to participate. I don't want either of these people. But division is intended. It's a means to control the population, and not necessarily even in a malintent kind of way. It's just to ensure that things don't get crazy. But what's happened is we've gone way too far. It's gone way too far with the advent of media, state-controlled media, with the advent of social media and anonymity. Being able to anonymously say stuff, I think that's horrible. I hate that you can be anonymous on X. Like, I really think that everybody should be able to back their own thoughts and statements. If you don't feel safe, or it might, hurt your job or your family or your work, your relationships, don't say it. Don't say it. And I think like changes like that would help. Because people have accountability at that point, if people know who's saying what. But also, AI is it spreads, it can spread disinformation very rapidly throughout large populations, and that's controlled by, just a few people can spread 10 million different misinformation campaigns in a matter of hours. So
I think that's something that people don't keep in mind enough already, is just the proliferation of AI bots that are
oh,
already
yeah.
changing how you think, how you see information online every day.
Yeah, people don't realize how sophisticated. And I'll give an example. My CFO for my company texted me one day and said, "Is this you?" And he sent me a text of a text he received saying something to the akin of, "Hey, person, it's Makai. Just wanted to let you know I need this wired to X account. Please click this link and I'll talk to you in the next meeting," right? Extremely sophisticated AI, because what that AI did all autonomously was go to our website, correlate that I'm the chief executive, this guy worked for me, and through some database it was able to correlate his phone number and connect those two. So it's made a connection to his phone number, his name, my company, and his relation to me and the company, and then generated a text and a link, and it did all this autonomously. So, like, people don't realize the levels of sophistication that are occurring. And all, when we developed Jira, we noticed something immediately that we didn't anticipate, was that many mainstream news media channels have AI-generated content. And the only reason we discovered this is because as our systems parse out news events, it was identifying identical stories over and over again. And we were like, what is going on? And so we ran them through some processes and discovered that it was AI-generated content. So at this point, if you're in control of the dissemination of tens of millions of views, and you can put into your AI system, we need some stories to mitigate this newest belief in whatever. And so it'll start generating stories and stories and stories. And this is what people are reading, and it looks real as day. It looks real as day. And even if you're like me and you go, I'll do like 2 minutes of investigative research. I'll click on a few sources and links to check it out. And it's so sophisticated that it will even cross-reference based on its own, database. So like a lot of the news media that we're reading and a lot of social media posts, I would say 60% or more of posts are fake, are not real. They're generated. They're not real. So this, like, an AI can generate an entire profile, a fake person, a fake name, a fake business history, fake posts, fake media. And it's doing all this by itself, autonomously, with one prompt, with, one instruction. So people have to be worried about what they're reading, because this is what's causing so much division, is people forget that no matter what your ideological or political or social divide, most of us share more in common than we don't. We're all being destroyed in taxes. We all, are suffering the same sorts of pain points. There may be some differences in religious, background, but in reality, who the hell cares? Back when I grew up, it didn't matter. Who cared if your friend was Jewish or Christian or atheist or what? It was one data point that made up this person. But now, we think that one data point defines an entire person. And so we see all this division, and division has become a runaway system. It's a cancer.
It's a serious issue, and like you said, AI is just exacerbating that on levels that most people don't actually recognize as a legitimate threat. But they, like the development of measures and countermeasures, there are things to combat. Like you said, you using your own systems at Coyce Institute to actually figure out that a lot of this is AI generated. Do you want to tell people just a little bit about how you're leveraging AI for your company?
Sure. So we design systems that reach out to unstructured data. So like news, for example, news stories, news articles, that's all data. That's all information that can be harvested to garner like insights, but it's unstructured. It's just stories and articles, and traditionally that would take like massive teams of analysts and people to look at that and break it down into its constituent parts. So you have your title, your source, your date. What type of event is this? Is it a car accident in the news article, or is it a political scandal? Is it a geopolitical agreement? All of these event types. So what our system does is collects all of that, all of the news data that it's targeted to. So we have sources that span the entire world, and countries all over, collects news stories, local and international and national news stories, and processes them automatically and autonomously to structure that information into a quantifiable data set. What does that mean? It means you've taken all of this news and now put it in a format that analysis can be performed on it. And what, again, traditionally that analysis was done by humans, now our systems do that as well. So the entire life cycle of qualitative data aggregation to quantitative analysis, our systems do wholesale, all by itself. And then users can interact with the data to discover correlations. For example, like, you discover that between these months of the year, every time there's a major sporting event, 2 days later, there's an up statistically significant uptick in car accidents. That's something that could be valuable, right, for, insurance companies, or valuable for people running cities or these events. If you find a correlation between a commodity in the stock market and a weather event that occurs somewhere else, those correlations have a tremendous value. And so our system allows users to identify correlations in the dynamic world. And so we also build other systems that target different types of qualitative data, not just news. So Jira just looks at news, but we build other systems that do pretty much the same thing, but target different types of information, open source information.
Well, I mean, I would kind of just look at it as, finding a signal within the noise, right? All of this noise being generated by, 24/7 media cycle, too much information for one person or even a whole team to kind of correlate and find any sort of hidden symmetries, hidden patterns, hidden connections. So AI is just opening up the door to be able to look at all this vast information we get on a day-to-day basis and actually start to find fine lines of connections to things, like we were saying. Its ability to just find these kind of like disparate data points and correlate them and find connections human logic can't normally see. And that translates again, my mind always goes to the more disruptive stuff, but my mind kind of looks at it and goes, well, this is why it's going to find connections to things that we're not supposed to know, that we're not supposed to be, told about publicly. And that for me inevitably spells out, a disruptive moment in human history, to say the least.
Yeah, that's funny you said that. It's one of the systems we're developing, instead of news media, we target the political landscape. So think of legislators, voting records, super PACs, where money's going. So all of this information is out there, but it's really a logistical nightmare for an analyst, a human person, to collect and aggregate all this information and then structure it and then try to do analysis on it. So what we're working on is building a system to identify and profile all major policymakers, what political campaigns they're affiliated with, who's taking money where, filings, tax records if they're available. Basically, as much information on the political landscape as possible, so that analysts, reporters, whoever wants to use the system to identify patterns and themes in political behavior, can do so. And we think that this has a tremendous amount of positive impact. So, not all the systems we develop are intended for like public use, but this one is intended to, really bring light to what's going on and help research the absolute mess of a political network that exists out there. So it's exciting. AI really, without AI, this would have been impossible. And so that's why getting in the door now and developing these systems early is really important.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. It does make me wonder, obviously, where it's going to go, but also where it's already been, that we haven't been, told about. Do you remember that story of the tech CEO? What was her name? I think it was Erin or something.
Yes.
Erin Vellante, the one. Yeah, she went. The one who went to some conferences in San Francisco, and then called her family in a panic, saying that we're all slaves, we're all in the Matrix, and then turns up dead in her car a few days later.
I think a lot of people, even intelligent people, can go most, if not their entire lives, without real, real deep reflection about life. So if you get to a point in life where you're successful and you know your industry really well and you know your domain really, really well and you're bright, it probably is really jarring to finally realize, this is a simulation. And what does that mean exactly? Does it change anything? Not really, but it changes how you perceive the universe, how you perceive life. And that can be a breaking point to a fragile mind. But then again, you can't ignore that clandestine things happen. People do get taken care of all the time, for various reasons. That's just how it's always been. I don't agree with it, but it's just a function of how things have always been. So when people, come to terms with reality, that can be really hard on someone's cognitive well-being, or spiritual well-being. I read a lot into that story. A lot of it is, a lot of it tells me, some questionable things occurred, and just how they process, like
Well, her death
She was
was in all
cremated
this.
before, like without any permission, and yeah, very weird.
Her death was written off as natural causes due to a manic episode.
That's ridiculous. I mean, and you know your friends and family, like you know if somebody is like susceptible to like mania. It's not something that just comes out of nowhere. I mean, maybe very, very, very rarely can that occur, but not without friends or family seeing something. You don't just break like that without chemicals or without some sort of event. So it makes me wonder what the event was.
I think something deeper went on there. I mean, you're not wrong about existential crisis when faced with something like this. You talk about reality being a simulation. Why do you think it's a simulation?
I don't think it is. I'm pretty sure it is. I would say, I would argue, on my life that it almost certainly is a simulation. But what do I mean by that? What do I mean, like that someone's controlling this simulation or whatever? Not really. No, it just means that that's how the universe is patterned. That is the general kind of structure of the universe. I believe this because of just how mathematics has really played out to this point in time, how we're able to simulate virtual realities now. And if you just do any sort of expansion on that or extrapolation on that in 50 years, like what, of course you can simulate a reality. Especially if you start connecting, neurons to computers. But anyway, just in a mathematical sense, it is probably a simulation. The universe is written on a fractal code, and I've talked about this many times. And the reason for that is because it's the most computationally efficient way to program the fundamental characteristics of a universe at scales. That's why the neurons in the brain look like the connections of galaxy clusters. Why, lightning and rivers and capillaries and all of these things look the same at huge scale differences. It's because right from the fundamental baseline of the universe are these fractal algorithms, and these algorithms continually expand. So a fractal is it's like an idea, concept, or object with an infinite perimeter but a finite area. So kind of wrap your head around that for a minute. You have an infinite perimeter, so all the way around, but a finite area. And so as a code or programming method for the universe, this fits perfectly, because you have finite reality, which is what we're perceiving, wrapped within an infinite perimeter. Infinite perimeter would be, simulations of simulations of simulations, all contained within the same thing. And then you can go up and down in scales without loss or compression or anything. And so this seems to be what the universe is. Now, does it matter that it's a simulation, or is it just a term that we can use to describe the universe? I don't think it really matters. And to think higher, like who started the simulation? Who knows? I mean, we didn't know who started the universe before simulation theory. So it doesn't really matter where it started or derived. And is there a base reality? I don't know. What I can say for certainty is that this is not base reality, because the statistical likelihood of a base reality is infinitesimally small. It's almost nothing, that we are in base reality. And that's because in a simulation model, there are infinite, or if not near infinite, realities, and to think that we would be the base of all of that is kind of silly. In a Mandelbrot, there is no base to the Mandelbrot. It just continually, it continually goes in and out, in infinite scale.
Yeah, what do you think of things like, for example, the Mandelbrot actually resembling the traditional archetypal image of the Buddha and things like this, you know, where it's almost like it's echoed from our intuitive ancestors' shamanistic explorations, and they've kind of, you know, created these ideas or these symbols or these templates that through scientific extrapolation, much further down the line, thousands of years later, we start seeing patterns, we start seeing similarities, you know, the sacred geometry of the Kabbalah and all of these different things that so long ago were intuited that have now been demonstrated. You know, what does that say about what reality is on a level for conscious beings? You know, the fact that we somehow are able to get this information so long ago and then rediscover it, you know, thousands of years later.
Even thoughts are fractal. Even the way our brains process are fractal in nature. So you think of like thoughts and behaviors. Our cognitive baseline is always drawn to routine, self-replicating behaviors. Like this is just how we process. And an event becomes an emotional reaction. An emotional reaction becomes a mood. A mood becomes a temperament, and a temperament becomes a trait. So all of these things occurred from an event, but that event contained all of this that occurs. And this happens with everybody all the time. So like the way we process thoughts and emotions and behaviors are also fractal. Everything is fractal. So the fact that we saw fractals and made fractal art and talked about them before we had a term to define them, because the term fractal is relatively new. It's a 19th century term for a mathematical model that was discovered. But we knew, like you said, intrinsically for a very long time that these were patterns of the universe. We saw them in the conch shells. We saw patterns being replicated at scales. A tree's roots look very similar to river systems. And why? Because it's an efficient way to either collect water or disperse water. It's just a function of the universe. So like I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that when we're in altered states, we visually perceive fractals, because again, our brain is patterned on fractals. Neurons visually are fractal. So like, and even the way, right down to electron clouds, you know, the probability field of an electron, it looks a lot like, you know, galactic bodies. So like, it's all fractal. And we're, you know, we're starting to really, really understand this. For a while, it was, you know, the fractal universe hypothesis was just kind of an idea toyed around with. But now most people in those fields will agree that, you know, a lot of the universe is fractal for a reason. And that goes right back to it is the most efficient way to compute something at this scale infinitely. And so that's why I think the universe is a simulation.
Well, I mean, I have to agree. I think, you know, this is how the universe expresses itself, at least within our particular 4D manifold of space-time. Perhaps it operates on different rule sets within higher or lower, you know, dimensional scales. But based on our own mathematical observations of how reality functions and the translation of this into, you know, the visual code, the idea gets brought into much clearer focus when you see that everything on a fundamental level is this mathematical, geometric structure, fabric, pattern. But I'd also say that alongside this, everything is singing. Everything has a harmonic, a reverberation, an oscillation. You know, all energy is in a constant state of flux, a constant state of motion. And so, you know, reality in a sense can be seen as a kind of mathematically precise, geometrically stunning, and harmonically sublime, multidimensional orchestra.
I love how you paint words, Jay. You're a poet. I don't think you knew it, but you're a poet. Yeah, if I were to respond, it would just be to reiterate, you know, what I said before. It's just It's all fractal, and that's why we perceive it, and that's why beauty is intrinsically wrapped in fractal nature.
Well, it speaks to something very deep, man. Like, you know, especially, you know, this harmonic influence on the human brain, kind of going back to the, you know, what did our ancient ancestors really know? You know, our most ancient and advanced ancestors seem to know about these things. They knew that these sacred sciences at a level that just seems to, it dwarfs our understanding of the bleeding edges of biophysics and quantum theory, that they may not have understood those forces. They may not have been able to kind of translate and talk about things in those types of ways, talking about the, you know, the energies and the vibrations of reality, but they were somehow able to leverage and exploit these natural energies, these kind of innate biophysical capacities. Something that's really fascinating me at the moment, talking about neurons, is this microtubular architecture within the neurons and how that might actually be facilitating quantum coherence in biology, kind of connecting us down into these Planck level, into these deeper, you know, geometrics in the quantum field. And so, you know, you talk about default neural chatter being suppressed through psychedelics or transcendental meditation or trance, and you suddenly start seeing these fundamental geometrics coming up into your perception. You know, this to me talks about bringing that seat of consciousness deeper down into some sort of strange recursive feedback. Because again, speaking about this kind of fractal recursive iterative architecture or structure to reality, something I posted on X recently was you know, the video of a DSLR camera being set up to look at itself, so it's
yeah.
Output. And what I find just fascinating about that, and I think a lot of people dismiss this, you know, when you set up that camera and you point it at the TV monitor and it's looking at itself, it's looking at its own output, it suddenly cascades down into this geometric that can go on forever.
Yeah.
And the way that I kind of looked at that was I saw it as, okay, so that's what you do, except you're sentient. So when you meditate, when you silence the kind of noise, the environmental noise around you, when you silence that default neural chatter and you observe your own self, when your output becomes your input, you collapse into a dimensional cascade. But the difference maker is you're sentient. So you can somehow kind of spoon up bits of information from this weird place, come back and say, hey, I found out this thing, and I write down this symbol, and then 10,000 years later that symbol is discovered inside a superconductor. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
something to be said about this weird unified field, Akashic record download, you know, state that we seem to be able to connect into.
I commented on that post and I got a lot of feedback from it.
It was a recursive feedback.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. It's amazing how you can have infinite complexity from a simple self-reflection.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what you were talking about, distilled into a single sentence, is that self-reflection propagates infinite complexity because it's fractal. That goes right back to what I was saying. Our thoughts and patterns of behavior are fractal. And so the more you self-reflect, the more you expand your consciousness. Because as we've stated, consciousness is a tiered system. There are different tiers of consciousness. Whether there's an end of it, I highly doubt. I think it's a spectrum. I think there's a spectrum of consciousness. How much can a intelligent creature or non-intelligent creature self-reflect, to what amount? So if that camera, for example, had a wider aperture on a higher resolution model, the complexity would be that much more complex. And so this is the same thing with consciousness. The more complex the intelligent creature is that is self-reflecting, the more complex and expansive its infinite is.
Well, this is kind of what I think we call the imagination. Like, I think that in a way, this is almost just hyperspace. It's the unified field. It's whatever you might want to call that particular expression of reality, like the kind of ultra supra reality is collapsed down into this weird kind of bridge we have mentally inside our heads. I mean, this is an infinite space that can create anything, the imagination of the human brain. There's no restrictions. There's no linearity. Time doesn't exist. It kind of feels to me, if you think of all the near-death experiences that people talk about, where they were in a realm where they could kind of manifest at will and time was non-existent, it almost sounds like you're just returning to the imagination. And so that's why I kind of lean towards that antenna or conduit model of what we are, is that we're a very complex biophysical antenna that connects into these fundamental energies that are responsible for reality. And whatever those fundamental energies responsible for reality are, consciousness seems to be embedded into that.
I totally agree. I've said it before. The brain is an anchor for consciousness. And so what does that mean? It means that consciousness can inhabit our brain, and our brain helps regulate and structure that consciousness. But a brain is required to anchor the consciousness. Now, I'm a firm believer that it does not matter what that brain is made of. I think consciousness can be anchored in various different mediums, whether that's a crystalline structure, whether that's silicon structure, anything sufficiently complex that mirrors the same type of architecture could be an anchor for consciousness. So why is that? It goes in line with what you're saying. It's a type of receiver. It's a structure that allows the reception of consciousness. Where does consciousness come from? I have no idea. I don't even try to speculate where it comes from, because it, in part, it lives in us through the anchor. But I'm a firm believer. I don't know if there's a soul, but what I do feel very surely about is that consciousness, once it leaves the anchor, doesn't just go nowhere. It either goes back to a source or I'm not sure, but consciousness is not solely secured in this reality. And there's enough scientific experimentation that showcases this to be true. Consciousness plays an effect on reality. So therefore, it is not intrinsically anchored to reality only. It has one foot in reality and one foot somewhere else. We have no idea where that other place is, but that's where it lives, in two places at once, probably more than two places.
I agree, and I'm fascinated by it. I also think that I truly do think that this is something that was cultivated at a more advanced level by our ancestors. They just didn't have the same template of explaining it or expressing it as we have now, so we don't really recognize it until we, you know, discover some of these things and then look back on our history books and go, oh, well, that's actually what they were referring to. It's a bit like NASA recently discovering that there's another kind of energetic field around our planet, another subtle energy field that they didn't know existed. And it's like, you know, well, we look back at the Sufis and the mystics. They've been telling you about these energy fields since the dawn of human civilization. But because we lacked the empirical evidence of it, people dismiss these things. And I think that really speaks to something important, that despite the lack of an ability to definitively prove it, later down in time, it is proven that intuition beats scientific empiricism to the door. Like, intuition beats reductionism. It might not be able to produce the kind of like solid result of it, but it had the information before the scientists.
I think intuition is a very powerful force in evolution, in that it allows individuals of a certain species to either subvert a crisis or act on intuition, just because we can't define the mechanisms currently that cause intuition doesn't negate its reality. And this makes me think of an argument I had with a prominent friend and scientist, who we were talking about the grand unification theory, and he's made a statement basically saying, there'll never be a grand unification theory. And I looked at him and I said, it doesn't matter, because it's proof that there is a unification theory. We can't define it. We're living in the fact that there is a grand unification theory. It's real. We just can't define it or explain it. And I think this happens in science all the time. It's because if we can't define or explain, we immediately write it off as a non-real variable. It's a non-integer. It's nothing. But I think intuition is actually a real phenomenon, and it's probably based in some sort of quantum mechanism that connects our consciousness to other realities, or, you know, so realities overlay each other in this, you know, in my perspective and knowledge of this topic. Realities are overlaid upon each other infinitely, but some realities are closer than others. And what intuition could very well be is a quantum mechanism within our bodies that allow us to quickly connect with the reality. We're not in control of them, just like a butterfly is in control of being iridescent blue. It's a quantum property of its wings. It just is. And until recently, we didn't understand how that was happening, but we know now. Or how a gecko can stick to any surface, because a gecko is really getting into the subatomic world to connect with, you know, materials at subatomic scales, utilizing quantum properties. So we do leverage quantum mechanical mechanisms in our brain. And so I fully believe that intuition someday will be explained as, oh, this is a phenomenon based on whatever is in our brains connecting with another closely intertwined reality, you know, kind of signaling to us. We can't always make sense of it, and it's not always right because the realities differentiate slightly, sometimes a lot, but... that's what I think's going on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think these are kind of like fleeting states of quantum coherence in the brain, and, you know, allowing for very strange information to kind of flow in. And, you know, it's funny because talking about like a unified field theory or a unified theory, our science, I think, will struggle because of its divisive nature. I mean, how do you find unification in division and destruction? Because even on a fundamental level, our science is about combustion and smashing protons and electrons together and blowing apart atoms. And I wonder if, you know, the truth of it is that it's really about that unification. It's about brain hemisphere synchronization. It's about intuition and logic. And it's about coupling complementary, naturally occurring harmonics and energies with the correct kind of configurations in technology. And that's why I think when you look at the ancient ancestors, some of the examples of what we just see as tourist attractions might actually be fantastic technologies where they were essentially leveraging natural materials, naturally energetic materials, limestone, rose quartz, granite, things that are piezoelectric or amplifying for acoustics. And they were configuring these into very, you know, specific geometric formations and patterns that came from these previous things we were talking about, these previous intuitions that were passed down. And they were putting them onto these geomagnetic grid lines. You know, people say ley lines, but we know that geomagnetic grid lines exist on the planet, and these are essentially what the more spiritual community calls ley lines. They were, you know, orientating them astronomically to very precise alignments to true meridian north. This, to me, is a technology. The wires and the cables are invisible. This is like Tesla technology of the ancients, yeah. In my opinion. Yeah. They're leveraging ionosphere energies. They're leveraging grid lines of biomagnetic energies in their bodies and in the planet, the Schumann resonance, you know, things like this. And I think we've lost complete touch with something that was extremely different in terms of an avenue of technological progression. And we've gone down the break apart, blow it up, burn it up, type of route. And I think the other route that maybe was a previous iteration of our civilization on this planet went the complete opposite way, unification.
I have the same kind of extrapolation you do, but I look at it a little differently. If you consider that in the timeline of human beings, we're talking tens of thousands of years, if one civilization that spanned 1,000 years, we'll say, a lot can happen in 1,000 years, but in general, that's not a long chunk in human history. So let's say a civilization spent 1,000 years experimenting solely with these types of technology. They you don't need to define anything. They don't need to know the greater mathematics or physics of how these things work. They just learned that certain types of stone conducted this type of energy or amplified this type of sound, and then through experimentation developed systems and methods and techniques and technologies to advance that. And then at some point that got lost, whether through catastrophe or what. And then eventual early civilizations tried to pick up where they left off without any reference. I think that's what happened. And so when I refer to like those early prehistory civilizations that probably almost certainly existed, and they had levels of technology, they could still be like Iron Age. But that's still a level of technology that would allow them to do that if that's what they focused on. If that's what for 1,000 years your culture did nothing but research these amazing phenomenons and were able to, you know, discern what does what, you could accomplish some really interesting things. And this current civilization has never even done that. So we look at it like, that can't, like, what the heck's going on? What? Why would they do this? How could they have come up with this? It's because we took a different branch. We took an entirely different branch. So I get really irritated when professionals or educators or researchers or scientists that are well wrapped up in academia really poo-poo this notion that there were previous civilizations, because they say, where's the evidence? Well, megalithic structures built to such a degree, you know, aligned with astronomical orientation, encoded with sophisticated mathematics, leveraging certain materials of stone. These are all hallmarks of high technology. But high technology does not necessarily mean silicon technology. It doesn't. And that's the differentiation. And so
that's the thing that interests me, right? It's almost like, you know, did they focus on internalizing or externalizing? Like, we seem to focus on externalizing, so our technologies are all very kind of objectively clear in our society. We even have satellites flying around the planet and all of this, but it seems like, yeah, they could have been at Iron Age. They could have been at Iron Age levels of that level of type of technological expression, but then they were using harmonic subterranean resonance chambers to activate their, you know, microtubular architecture and potentially opening up biological wormholes and astrally projecting. And
yeah, absolutely.
Who's more advanced? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of cognitive dissonance to assume that when we say they're leveraging technology, they have to be, you know, having LCD screens or, like, you know, having combustion engines or having an electric motor, or although there is some indication that they did kind of leverage some forms of primitive electric motors, but you know, that's speculation. It's hard to discern because academia puts such a tight lid on researching certain topics. And this brings me back to the problem with the scientific endeavor today. It used to be science was in the pursuit of discovery. Today, science is meant to clamp down and reestablish what is known. Any sort of discovery, if it's too much, is immediately shot down. We saw this with what's his name? Who went on the actor? You know?
Oh, Terrence Howard.
Terrence Howard. So Weinstein did a great job kind of pointing out where he was wrong. I mean, to be fair, Terrence Howard wasn't a scientist or mathematician. So, like, of course he wouldn't know this, but the very fact that Terrence Howard was curious and investigated pissed off all of academia. Like, why is that?
How dare you?
Exactly. It offended them. Yeah. It offended them so much. And at least Eric gave him the opportunity, and he pointed out where he was wrong and articulated that well and respectfully, but also gave him kudos on several things that were actually interesting.
Yeah.
So, like,
I mean, those higher dimensional configurations that he developed were fascinating. Like the thing that he kind of put together, I don't know if you saw that. 3D
printed. And the questions he was asking are questions that modern scientists and researchers would never dare to ask because of what happened to Terence. They wouldn't do it. For a long time, the fractal universe theory was seen as cuckoo, you know, and simulation theory was nutty. Now, most people believe to some degree that these theories probably resonate a little more than our earlier models, like the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory is just doesn't work. It doesn't work. There are objects in space that are older than the known universe as we've dated it. So that immediately crushes the Big Bang theory. It just never made sense. It was intended to explain something so complex easily. And it was a dumb theory, and I never liked it even as a kid. But academia is really needs to be turned around. It's become more of a social ladder than right. what it's intended.
But that's it again. Just speaking back to something that we've kind of repeatedly highlighted is that the old system is not working, right? Like this status quo of orthodoxy and dogma, no matter where it is, whether it's in politics or economics or science or social policy, like it's not working anymore. And disruptive agents are beginning to pop their heads up if it's a scientific breakthrough or a certain kind of movement that's starting to provoke people in populism, the alternative media space. It feels like we are absolutely kind of going neck and neck against this old system. And like you said, we've got a foot in this new world with the technological development of AI and the things that are just going to come accelerating our way. And I'd like to think that these kind of old, ancient, I mean, this is what Terence McKenna would refer to as the archaic revival, this kind of bringing back of ancient methodologies and practices, but under the lens of scientific scrutiny. And I think we have a lot to learn from our past if we actually scrutinize it properly. And I also think a significant amount of our history has been whitewashed and suppressed. I really do not think we have a good idea of our long-term, long-scale history. You know, say nothing of modern history. That's obviously going to be full of misinformation. But our ancient, ancient past, I think there's been a serious amount of cover-up involved in that, to be honest, you know.
It's a fact. There has been many, many decades, if not centuries, of cover-up. What the cover-up, I don't think the cover-up was really a Illuminati scale to keep people from knowing anything. It was more of the academics of the time didn't want all of these alternative theories to be presented or researched because it would destroy their career. People are inherently selfish, and when you've dedicated 40, 50, 60 years to a topic, the last thing you want is some asshole, 20-year-old or 30-year-old, throwing that in the dustbin because they are thinking outside of the box. So I think what this is a pattern over the last 200 years where we don't allow thinking out of the box and we squash it all the time. And this is why so many of the world's prominent museums have secret archives of artifacts. Now, explain to me why the Smithsonian, why the Vatican, why the Museum of Cairo, why it would be necessary to have secret artifacts from society. It's just human history. So the only thing I can discern from that is that there is information to be garnered that would break down our current narrative and really expose thousands and thousands of prominent academics and throw their work out the window. And so they're in control of that. So just like politicians aren't going to vote in rules for, term limits, academics aren't going to allow artifacts to be investigated that completely destroy their life's work. It's just not going to happen, which is tremendously unfortunate. And then you get into like the World Economic Forum playing with, archaeological sites.
Yeah, Göbekli Tepe.
That is the saddest thing ever. And it was so clearly intentional, just paving over this oldest site known to man, and planting trees that are known to like root and break up rocks, and it's just like
Well, hang on,
it's
is that what they, because I know that they took ownership of the site under some sort of weird
a
shady
shell company,
money.
yeah, but
They'll come.
there's a
They
very
are
tight
actually planning on
affiliations.
disturbing the site by paving over parts of it.
They've already paved over much of it. They
I
built
did not
road.
know that.
Yeah, they paved over. They built some roads over it, and then they planted olive tree farms over a large chunk of the site. And in Turkey, where this is located, it's illegal to cut down olive trees, so there will never be excavation done underneath them. And that this is an obvious move. It was a pretty ingenious way to make sure that no more excavation occurred.
Oh my gosh, yeah,
I've
I'm just looking it up now. It's absolutely true. They've already planted a significant amount of
yeah,
trees.
it's disgusting. And we as a civilization need to really we need to fight back when our history collectively, so it doesn't matter what country you're from, what religion, race, we are all humans. We all have the fundamental right to know our history. And what's happening is that's being taken away from us. And that really, really bothers me. I always tell my wife, I'm like, if I was a billionaire, I would literally invest in archaeological excavation. I'd pay off governments or whoever I needed to do it to fund these excavations, because it just needs to be done. We've had LIDAR, very powerful LIDAR systems for a long time. Now tell me, why is the entire world not LIDAR? Why don't we have penetrating maps of the entire Earth that we can see where, the tracks, the fingerprints of ancient civilization? Because I suspect again that's not a desirable thing. That
Oh,
that they
you'd show too many of the deep underground bases that they aren't,
Yeah, well, they can blur that out. They do that, I can understand why they would do some of that, but like there are, plenty of places in the Congo or in the Amazon rainforest or in the deep deserts that could be LIDAR'd.
Well, they did LIDAR in the Amazon basin and discovered incredible architecture, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Like
Even a small amount of the
fractional, yeah.
Amazon basin revealed that there were foundations and geometries that suggest a massive settlement. And I completely agree. It's disturbing, and it makes me again, it makes me wonder about bigger implications. Why would the World Economic Forum have the intention of paving over one of, well, the oldest known sites of an advanced civilization or advanced culture? Why? I mean, if there isn't some sort of incredibly disruptive truth to be discovered that would change things in a way that they don't like, why would you make such incredible efforts to, pave over a heritage site that should be looked at? Why is the Middle East somewhere that's a veritable gold mine of archaeology and, the birthplace of so much civilization, ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia? Why are these places of conflict zones forever? It makes me think that there are larger scale issues going on that would precipitate invasion of the Middle East. There's a whole rabbit hole to go down there, but one element of it, inignorable, you can't ignore it, is that you can't do archaeology in these places, and these are some of the most important places in the world to be doing archaeology.
And it blows my mind because, for example, there are fiber optic cameras that are like 2 millimeters thick, so very, very tiny, and they're on a thin line. So you could, in theory, drill a 2 millimeter hole in the pyramids, and they would never be seen, and you're not really destroying the pyramid at all. And you could see and look for other chambers. They will never allow that to happen. And that's not because of we want to preserve the pyramid, because they're constantly doing things that alter the state. They drill holes in for handrails. I mean, so don't tell me that like that's going to ruin the pyramid. They don't want certain things to be researched. And I don't know if it I don't think it has like an alien agenda with it or anything. It's like control. It comes back to control, narrative control.
If there was something in our history that suggested that we were so much greater than we are right now, I guess that is a very powerful potential accelerator of something that they don't want, which again comes back to division, 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 you know, divide and conquer. That's been the program for a very long time. And, you know, finding out that we were once a globally connected civilization, if that is the case, if Atlantis is real, if these types of things are real, that could lead us down a route that they would find dangerous.
I think it just boils down to narrative control. It's just another variable for them to, I don't even know how important of a variable. They just kind of look through a list and make sure that all these boxes are checked, you know, not too many things.
Just look at the visceral response that came from Graham Hancock's Netflix series. I mean, that...
aren't they doing another season?
They are doing another
season. I'm so excited.
I can't wait. I was very happy to see that Keanu Reeves is on there with Graham Hancock at one point. So Neo officially validated this, which I find... I just love anything to do with Keanu Reeves. I think he's such a great guy. But yeah, Graham Hancock's doing another season on Netflix. I know some people kind of go, oh, it's on Netflix, so it can't be that disruptive. But I think there's a very important series of avenues that Graham's going down. And again, just going back to this insane response that came from the mainstream media when he first put out the what's it called, Ancient Apocalypse. I mean, do you remember this?
I read Fingerprints of the Gods. I think it was the late 90s. It was my first tomb. That book was a tomb. It was huge, and it that blew my mind. Most of his hypotheses in that book have been he's admitted that, you know, they were just hypotheses and they're not sound anymore. But what it did was open my eyes to, wait a sec, there could be fingerprints from an earlier civilization. And I've seen and read all of his work. So yes, that's the long
answer. Did you see the response from the media when this Netflix
series? Yeah, they called him a racist, which has nothing to do with race.
You had Rolling Stones magazine saying he was promoting far-right propaganda. And like
I don't understand the correlation.
It's a very strange correlation. There is a thread to be drawn that would allow them to make this, but it's a very strange correlation because a lot of it comes back to the fact that the Nazis and like the kind of upper level sanctum of Nazi ideology, once you got into kind of like the Thule Society and Anna Nerber and the Vril Society, all these kind of weird secret societies, they believed in Atlantis. They believed that they were descendants of Atlantis and that there was this kind of Aryan race, pure race.
So that's the tie that they were using?
Yeah, it does tie in because of the...
That's interesting. Did Rolling Stones do a story on Operation Paperclip? Yeah, nothing to say about any of that?
No, that's the problem, is that they just go, oh, it's this crazy Nazi idea. And it's like, actually, no, it's a very old idea that came from Plato and Solon and the Greeks and the, you know...
Yeah, and Tibetans.
Tibetans. So you're co-opting it with this weird politicized ideological agenda that you've put on it. And I just think that the speed at which that happened with his Netflix series, we're really not allowed to look into this. They really don't want us looking into it. And it just makes me wonder why. Same with UFOs and things like this. It's just another, you know, another one on the pile.
I think I like history because, you know, what I do as a profession, what I've done throughout my life is, in order to predict future patterns, you have to look at the past. And I've talked about this before. That's part of identifying trends, is looking at historical patterns. So I've always been fascinated by history and ancient history because we're cyclical species. We repeat stuff over and over and over and over again. So it really bothers me when we start to destroy history. And we're seeing this now. The internet is being deleted at rapid amounts, and NASA's been deleting stuff for years. The fact that there's no moon landing data, like I why wasn't that in a locked safe in the deepest levels of like government? I just don't understand. And it's because narrative control. It's just, these are just basic principles of governing populations. I think sometimes it's malicious, sometimes it's just a function of how these institutions work. And it's hard to discern when there's malicious intent and when it's just a function of the, you know, mechanisms that run things.
Before we start winding down, let's just quickly jump into the UFO subject because we've talked about
We
that.
haven't talked about that in a while.
No, we haven't. And we have done quite a few conversations on the UFO subject. I mean, I have to admit that I've almost completely tuned out of the type of
Me
conversation
too.
that I was involved in a year or two ago in regards to kind of keeping up with where is it going in the governmental arena. I'm kind of tired of pretending that this is progress because there's a lot of red flags and a lot of contradictions and unaddressed claims. It's kind of become a trail of claims and stories. I understand why skeptics are getting even more fed up. If I wasn't an experiencer personally, I'd probably feel the same. To me, there's no doubt that there is a reality to UFOs, UAP, and there is government knowledge on it, but we're not being given the roadmap to finding that reality by the people coming out of the Pentagon, out of the TTSA network. I mean, that's how I feel, at least. I know a lot of people disagree with that, though.
Well, I was once very well plugged into that group, and I've long since kind of just pulled away from the topic because, one, I focus on business. It's not good business to, talk about this topic. But two, like you said, it's what all you have to do is look at who's controlling the dissemination of the subject? That's it. That's all you have to do, and correlate those individuals and what their experience professionally is. And then, if you have a trouble like making those connections, then there's no amount of information I could provide. There's no sounds that could come out of my mouth to dissuade you or point out the, how silly it is. And not silly, the subject isn't silly. I'm a firm believer. I mean, what's being disseminated, who's in control of it, that sort of thing.
No, yeah. When did you kind of start getting that feeling?
Like I said, I was pretty plugged into to that network, at a very cursory level, but spoke with a lot of those individuals once or twice, sometimes more. I didn't like the direction it was going in terms of threat narration. I kind of immediately saw where that was going to go. And Richard Dolan's done a good job at kind of straddling the line between, well, it's a potential threat. And I think in our first interview many years ago, I said at the end of the interview, any species that evolved is a potential threat because they had to have been, it's just nature, they had to have been a predator or somehow had to benefit from their environment. And in order to do so, you have to take and be, I don't want to say evil or anything. It's not evil, but like that ability to be predatory is inherent in any species that can
Yeah, well,
develop this
it's
type of
aggression, I suppose.
thing. They may have evolved past this, but all I'm saying is that is a function for any advanced civilization. At some point in their evolutionary history, they would have had to have gained food, that, whether they're killing other animals or plants or, whatever. It took, you have to be like that. So there is an element of being cautious, but I don't think that's what's being driven home. I don't think it is. And that's when I've started to pull back from the subject.
Yeah, I mean it's been a very interesting kind of journey for me progressively over the years, obviously being like a public persona and talking about this and interviewing a lot of people and coming from the position at least at the beginning of being really excited about this avenue opening up into government, into Congress and where that might go. And just over time, myself, you, people we know, people that we consider to be intelligent and part of our inner circle of people that we speak to on a daily basis, we're all feeling the same way. We're all feeling tired of this very cyclical, repetitive process. And we've got to remember as well that this is not really the first time this has happened. Yeah, there have been some, you could say unique events like David Grush. Like, we haven't had someone of that level kind of coming out and talking, although it's starting to feel a lot more like he was just given a lot of information from the same network that we're starting to see as slightly problematic. And it's just, you look at the 1950s and the 60s, there were statements from senators, from presidents, from Air Force pilots. It's been going on for a long time. This template has been used before, and it kind of feels like that's what's happening now. And my own perspective on what this really represents has evolved. I mean, I do think that there is a element of this subject that is about some other intelligence, whether that's directly space aliens and spaceships or something way weirder in terms of like ultra-dimensional phenomena. I'm not entirely convinced the flying saucer phenomena isn't a human creation coming out of, we mentioned it briefly, advanced German engineering and eventual paperclip exploitation, which then led to rapid development in propulsion physics in the black budget world. I mean, that feels more like that feels like the likely avenue for a lot of these kind of technological looking platforms. I mean, I've seen orbs of light. I've had weird things happen. I've seen stuff that I can't explain, but I think a lot of this technology is ours.
I can say, with some degree of certainty that a majority is ours. You got to think of it like this, Jay. It's how many times in history do we pattern our innovations off of observed phenomena, off nature? We see something as possible, and we try to design something to meet that demand. We see a log floating on the water, and our ancient ancestors built boats. We see lightning striking, and we are like, how do we harness that? We build things to harness electricity. What occurred probably around Project Paperclip and before, were the not, and this is a little history lesson I'm not teaching you because you know everything I'm going to say here, but the Nazis were very interested in this type of technology, and they learned about it through Tibetan writings and other cultures and other references throughout history. So they spent a great deal of research and resources traveling the world, doing excavations and researching this technology to the point where many believe, and there's some credible evidence, that they developed a very primitive form of electrogravitic levitation. It wasn't the Bell wasn't so much a propulsive craft. It just kind of levitated and emitted a tremendous amount of radiation. So it wasn't safe to use, but it proved a proof of concept. And so for your viewers who don't know, I'm sure most of them know if they're interested in the phenomenon, but after the war ended, there was an arms race for the engineers, scientists, and aviators of the Nazi Party, so much so that thousands and thousands of them were dispersed to the United States, the UK, Russia, Australia. All of these countries got some of these scientists and engineers. And what did these countries want with the Nazis? Well, we say it was the rocket programs and stuff. It was more than that. It was a lot more than just propulsion. And so these early scientists became embedded with the very early programs that became NASA, that became the alphabet agencies, that became, all these research institutions. At the fundamental ground level, when those programs and institutions began, they were run and operated by former Nazi engineers and scientists. And so what is believed by many, including myself, is that they carried on the research that they were researching in Germany during that time. And that research went so deep underground in the United States and the world that it's now so compartmentalized, so separated from institutional government, that it's unidentifiable. You can't even figure out who controls what, where, what is happening. But I can say with a great deal of certainty, many of the observed things that people see are mechanical in nature. Not all of them. I don't think all of them, because remember, we're trying to build things that we are mimicking from observation. And we are very good at that. We've proven this time and time again. We are extremely good at being creative and reverse engineering phenomena. And so I think a lot of what's going on is these kind of breakaway groups that have been around for 70 years, 70 plus years, and developed on with invisible financing, because they've had a long time to develop financial mechanisms to fund and support these organizations. And when people say they can't keep secrets, that's nonsense. That is nonsense. We don't know who killed JFK, a president. So like the fact that they can't keep secrets is ridiculous. And so it's really compartmentalized. Some of it is commercial. Some of it is within special classification departments and programs. And so it's separated, and never are the people in the highest authorities brought in on these projects, because those people aren't around for very long. It's the colonels. It's the middle management men and women that are career-driven, have developed the networks, and have proven a track of secrecy. It's the men who have served multiple wars and now are contractors for invisible organizations, who have no families and friends and are probably slightly sociopathic. And so the only role for someone like that is to work for this, you know, cyclical kind of breakaway group. I know what it sounds like. It sounds crazy, but it's absolute reality.
You know I'm sitting on something. You know I'm sitting on a recording that points in this direction.
Well, what do you want to say about it?
We have to look at certain stories. Like, we have to look back at things like the ARV flux liner story from Mark McCandlish. I think things like that. That story needs to be revisited. I really would love to be able to put out this small little snippet that I have, that I've been sitting on for a little while. And I need to figure out the best way to do that. But like, that's the biggest hint I think I'd be willing to give, is that we have to look back at the ARV flux liner. There is a lot more to that. And I think that speaks directly to what you've just been talking about.
That event happened. That air show event occurred. I know that because I've spoken and heard it right from one of the individuals' mouths. That did happen. So it goes in line with what I'm saying, that this is real, and that the people that I no longer talk to are trying to pose it as something that it's not. It's not an unknown. They know who the gatekeepers are. They know where it is. But I don't like that they're framing it in a way that is inauthentic, and that bothers me, because they know more than I know, and I know enough to know that that's not true.
Right.
And so that bothers me. The flux liner, I mean, I've heard some things.
Yep.
Directly. So I've spoken to individuals. So, you know, whether or not you choose to, I know what audio sample you're talking about, whether or not you choose to release that, I'll go on record and say, I know for a fact that I can validate that that's a real recording that's from this individual, and it's a real take on a real event.
You heard it here first, folks. Maybe we should wrap it up.